Ava Ichikovic is a he's an entrepreneur of great repute, but very under the radar. And I suppose the reason for that is because of what he does. He also, however, has a foundation which does something unusual as well. And it's interesting to listen to the feedback on his family's foundation, or rather his company's foundation. And that is to say that, nobody else does this, so we got to kind of listen to them. And the reason why there is this controversy around him is his business, and his business is in the defense field. Now, Ava, I haven't seen any interviews that you've done in the past. I'm sure you have, but it does appear to me to be quite clear that you're very passionate about what the Africa Youth Survey has achieved and what it's busy doing, and so passionate that you want to come talk about that today, despite the fact that you must have thought, wow, there's a gotcha coming here.
I think, you know what, when you've been at this for as long as I have, I think that you expect gotchas around every corner. But the reality is that, you know, I'm an African, I'm an Afro-optimist, I'm an investor in Africa in many different industries. And I'm passionate about the continent. And I think that that I'm prepared to put myself out there and take that risk to be able to communicate some of the exciting information that we collect every time we do one of these surveys.
And according to the information I have, you turn 60 next month. So
yeah, I turn 60 next month. I've never felt younger. I've never felt more energetic. I've never felt more optimistic about the continent than I do now. And sadly, the years are catching up on all of us.
Yeah, even Helen Ziller. But she's still at it a lot older than the 60-year-old. So that's good.
Strength to her elbow. I hope that I can be half as strong at her age.
But tell me what the Paramount story. It is the biggest private defense company on the African continent. As your various court issues with various media companies have said, where did it all start? I do know that your dad imported Suzukis, so Suzuki motorbikes, which I think I might have even ridden one of those many years ago. But where did you get the idea to go into what is always going to be a controversial area?
So if there was anybody ever voted as least likely to go into the defense industry, it was me. But I was at Wits University. I studied dramatic art, believe it or not. I was kind of associated with the late days, the kind of dying days of the struggle, and became a political activist, and fell very much in love with Africa and the African continent. And I think that one of my realizations was that there were massive expectations of South Africa in the rest of Africa at that stage. You know, everybody expected Nelson Mandela was going to arrive, he was going to wave a magic wand, and he was going to fix every single one of the ills in Africa. And I knew and I realized that that was never going to be possible, but that that he needed, and the country needed, and the government needed every bit of help they could get from the private sector to go and take what South Africa had and help the rest of the continent by transferring that capability. And, you know, totally by chance, I became exposed to the defense industry. I was never in the army. I was never, that was never my inclination. But I realized that the future of democracy in Africa depended on one thing and one thing only, and that was our ability to defend these hard-won democracies. You know, at that moment in time, Africa was very heavily polarized. It was very much in the hands of the post-Soviet Union, or the Soviet Union that had just kind of collapsed. And it needed to be, African governments needed to become far less dependent on outside powers to defend themselves. And I felt that South Africa had the capability to assist with that. And that's how I got involved in the industry. I mean, as ridiculous as it sounds, it's started with ideology. And I must say that if I had, hindsight is 20/20 vision, I could not have chosen a more difficult, more controversial industry. But I'm very proud to say that we first of all managed to salvage an industry in South Africa that is absolutely a cornerstone of the economy of this country. You know, there's no country in the world that has gone from a developing economy to a developed economy without a strong defense industry. The innovations that we have been able to maintain and develop in South Africa through the defense industry are unbelievable. My biggest sadness is that South Africans and the South African government don't understand the national asset that we sit with here. You know, today Paramount is sadly the last man standing. It was inevitable that the state-owned defense industry, despite passionate, very capable people that were in it, has been denuded to virtually nothing. And that, for me, is an absolute tragedy. You know, at a time when the rest of the world is hankering after defense industrial sovereignty, we have it. We have the ability to build an aircraft from scratch and put it into the international market. I mean, one of the very few, probably five in the last 50 years, military aircraft that have been developed in private hands and gone from concept all the way into commercial production in the world has happened here in South Africa and sits within the Paramount Group. We are the world's leaders in landmine-protected armored vehicles still today in the world, with more than 4,000 units in active service in the world. And South Africans don't even realize this. And I'm afraid part of the reason that we talk about Afro-optimism, the part of the reason that we talk about whether the youth in Africa are optimistic or pessimistic is because that perception is what drives reality in this country. Because South Africans tend to be so pessimistic about what's going on around them, they don't engage with these things. And, you know, although today I'm no longer active in the defense business from an operational point of view, I'm still very, very much a proud founder of Paramount, which is today a global business. South Africa and our footprint in South Africa represents a very, very small part of our global business. And I'm very proud of what we've managed to achieve as Africans in the defense industry, which is such an incredibly complex and competitive industry around the world.
Yeah, it sure is. But give us some sense of the size or the scale of Paramount today.
Well, Paramount today operates in 20 countries around the world. We partner with governments in Central Asia, in Central Europe, in South America, in the Middle East, in Asia, and of course in Europe and the United States. We supply, we manufacture, we're an industrial organization that designs, develops, and manufactures advanced defense and aerospace platforms. And I think very importantly, there are very few companies in the world that produce platforms. We build ships, we build advanced land systems, vehicles and armored vehicles, and we build airplanes. So, you know, to say we're in people think of the defense industry as the arms industry. Well, we're not in the arms industry in that we don't make weapons and munition. We make the platforms that allow people to go onto the battlefield and to perform their duties safely.
Was that a personal choice not to go into something that kills people but maybe protects?
You know what? It was very much a personal choice. I felt that one of the biggest issues we had in Africa at the time is that African governments hadn't yet realized the value of human life on the battlefield. And a lot of African governments, and please let me be clear, that's no longer the case. But when I got into this 35 years ago, African lives were disposable. And I felt that every African government needed the ability to send their soldiers into the battlefield in a safe environment so that they could do their jobs. And that's, we started in the landmine protected armored vehicle business. And in those days, we did something really very unique. Everybody focused on protecting their vehicles so that if their vehicles got hit by a landmine, the vehicle would survive. I said, to hell with that. I'm concerned about human survivability. We're one of the first defense companies in the world that put crash test dummies into our vehicles. You cannot imagine the drama I had getting the CSIR and others to give us their crash test dummies so that we could blow them up in vehicles. But it started a whole new wave in the defense industry that started focusing people's minds on the value of human life and protecting life rather than protecting capital equipment.
So what took you from there to creating a foundation? It's now 15, 16 years old, and a foundation that does a survey of the young people in Africa, and one that, even though many of your critics don't want to refer to it have to, because it's the only one that's there.
Well, I think that the first of all, the foundation started with the African Oral History Foundation. And I felt that I'd had the privilege of living through some very exciting periods in South Africa's history and in Africa's history. And I realized that the reason that I was so privileged is because I knew the people on the stage at the time. I had the opportunity to get to know the left-hand side and the right-hand side and everybody in the middle. And I realized that our history had been made not by kind of a command and control environment. It had been created by the very unique individuals that were on the stage at that time, and their stories needed to be told. And I was very worried that future generations would have stories told about these people, and that these people wouldn't have an opportunity to tell their own stories. And I suppose to a certain extent, they're inspired by the Shoah Foundation, which was something that Steven Spielberg set up to record the original testimony of the Holocaust. I decided to create the African Oral History Archive to allow people to tell their stories. And that turned into an incredibly interesting project. We've got just thousands of hours of original testimony of many, many people who sadly are no longer around to tell their stories. Out of that came the epic saga project that I've just completed, which is the Winnie Mandela documentary, which is now airing on Netflix. And that documentary would never have been possible if we hadn't started collecting this archive material 15 or 16 years ago. So it really has been a project of passion. But as I then evolved through the process of finding a niche and a role for this foundation, I realized that one of the biggest challenges we had in Africa is that the whole world talks about Africa. Even Africans talk about Africa without actually really knowing what they're talking about. You know, as I moved through the boardrooms of the world, and you know, despite the fact that the defense industry is an important part of our of my history and my life, we're invested in many, many industries all over the African continent. And as I've moved through the world, I realized that my view, my lived view of Africa, was so vastly different to the perceptions that people abroad and even people in Africa had of the continent. And I felt that either I was completely wrong and I needed to go and prove out whether what I was feeling or perceiving about the continent was true or not, or I was right and they were all wrong. And we realized that the only way you could ever tell the truth about a continent was to go and talk to the youth. Because, first of all, this is a generation of leaders in waiting, and you don't want to tell, you don't want to go and validate the past, because that's already happened. You want to go and look into the future. You want to go and get a sense of how young leaders perceive their future and where they want to take the continent. And that's how the youth survey started. First of all, I went out and looked for data. So there must be data. Well, Eric, there is no data. Nobody's ever bothered to go and do this. And I'm not claiming that we're particularly genius. The fact is, we just went out and looked for stuff that didn't exist and decided, look, this is not optional. The continent is moving so fast. I have so many questions about the continent that I want answered, but I want to put proper science behind it. So we put a lot of investment in time, in effort, in resource to creating a very, very robust scientific project, which would go and every 4 years survey the entire continent. So what we do is we do 16 countries in detail every single year. These are 1 hour face-to-face interviews conducted with a very broad demographic that represents the entire country that we deal with. And we come up with a Pan-African picture, which then allows us to drill into country by country. And we've developed the most incredibly deep data set, which today is available to decision makers around the world so that they can back their decisions with fact, not just kind of glib perception. And I think that it certainly fascinates me every single time, which is why I love talking to it, because it just validates the fact that we live and work on the most exciting continent in the world.
And the fastest growing in terms of population, no doubt, as
well. And the fastest changing. I mean, the rate of change on this continent, the rate of evolution of the attitude of the people on this continent is unbelievable.
But the headline that came out of the report, out of this research document, nearly 5,000 people that were interviewed, as you say, face-to-face, 1 hour each, was China is more enjoyed or more appreciated by the African youth than the United States. Now, is that because they're misinformed? Is that because they really understand that censorship and freedom, which are hectic things in the African continent, people have died generations for freedom, and that they don't exist in China? And that on the other hand, those who personify those the freedom, if you like, on the West, are kind of sliding down the scale amongst the youth and becoming less loved?
So what we find is that when we started the survey, there's no question the United States was perceived to be Africa's most important partner. It was also perceived to be Africa's most influential partner. And it was perceived to be ideologically the partner that most African youth wanted to kind of pin their flags to. However, as things evolved post-COVID, that changed exponentially. Because during the COVID experience, the United States was nowhere to be seen in Africa. But what was left on the continent were the telecommunications infrastructure that the Chinese had invested in and built, the dams that China had invested in and built, the stadiums China had invested in and built, the roads that China had invested in and built, and frankly, even the jobs that China had invested in by building mines and industrial activities. And I think that in that vacuum, the evidence of China's tangible, really measurable activity in Africa became very real to most young Africans. And then it was no longer about ideology. It was no longer about perception. It was about lived reality. And I think that that's the reason why China today is respected as much as it is. Look, young Africans are no longer, when what the survey is telling us is that young Africans are no longer interested in ideology. They're no longer interested in backing a political system. They want partners that are going to partner with them as equals, that are going to respect them, and that are going to invest in creating high value jobs and taking the continent to the next level. Now, the United States is falling behind fast because young Africans are sick and tired of being lectured to. They're sick and tired about being told about their ideology. They want to see tangible investment. And I think this is a message to the West. I mean, Europe is falling far behind. France is falling far behind. And part of the reason for this is because even though young Africans really do believe that there's space for everybody, they're demanding actual transactional performance. And I think that in some ways, it's a really positive thing because the continent is no longer about ideology. It's about investment. It's about performance. It's about creating jobs.
Yo, and Donald Trump would certainly not have helped the perception from the West's point of view with his actions and activities.
Yet, Alec, very interesting to me is that the perception about Trump is not altogether negative. You know, there is, albeit that there nobody, I mean, very few people that we survey agree with anything he's had to say. Most African youth believe that their governments have to deal with him. America's important. They understand the four-year political cycle. They understand that Donald Trump is not America. In some cases, they actually respect his strong style of leadership, because the other thing that comes out of the survey, which I find very fascinating, is that most African youth believe in democracy as the correct style of government, but they don't believe in the Western style of democracy that we have inherited from Europe and from elsewhere. And I think that part of what they see as an African style of democracy is very strong leadership that is prepared to stand up for their country's rights. And I think that they respect in Donald Trump, even though they don't necessarily agree with what he has to say or with the ideology that he broadcasts.
Sounds like a very thin line, though, between the big man of Africa that we were cursed with for so many generations and a strong Democrat. So how does one, or is it just the naivety and perhaps idealism of youth that is coming through here, or is it reality that they're seeing around?
Look, I think there's a combination of both. What progressive editions of the survey are telling us is that there is a debate going on amongst the African youth about what the right form of democracy is. There is a general acceptance that a inclusive, representative form of governance is necessary. But there is this total lack of trust and belief in the election system. I think that throughout the continent, the whole idea of elections has been completely discredited. And as a result, the youth are looking for a way to have an inclusive democratic system, but to have strong African-style leadership. It's too early for us to tell exactly what this is going to look like. In fact, we've already started working on the next edition of the survey, and a big focus for us is to start drilling down into what this actually means. You know, when you have a demographic like this, that is, first of all, your first ever completely born-free generation of leaders. This is the first generation of leaders that never experienced colonialism, never experienced apartheid, never experienced the propaganda that came with apartheid and colonialism, which was focused on convincing Africans that they were in some way dependent. If you think about it, those ideologies stood on the fact that Africans were dependent, that they needed to be saved, that aid was going to be the way that Africa was going to evolve. This is a generation that don't believe in that at all. In fact, if anything, they're specifically saying we don't want aid. We don't want to be reliant on anybody. And this generation is saying we don't like the fact that the electoral system has failed us. And we are truly African. We want to look backwards into our African roots and look at how an African style of leadership works. You know, if I think that we're now looking at drilling into this so that we can start the debate. It's a debate that's happening anyway. Let's start understanding exactly where it's going to lead us. But this same generation, the same group of people are saying we want democracy, but we're not going to vote. I mean, in South Africa, 30% of the youth that we talk to tell us that they're not going to vote in the next elections.
Why?
You tell me. I believe that it is because of a total lack of faith in the integrity of the voting system. Now, the other thing that this survey tells us is that one of the youth are done with corruption. They see it in every single aspect of their lives. And one of their biggest demands to their governments is to deal with corruption. Now, corruption in the electoral system, corruption all over the rest of the aspects of their lives, starting to make them feel very pessimistic about the institutions that have been created. Now, you know, when we look at youth optimism and we see that the African youth are more optimistic than they've ever been before, don't confuse that with satisfaction. This is not the African youth saying, we're happy with what our governments are doing. We're happy with the institutions. What they're actually telling us is that they have found their voices. They're optimistic because they realize that their futures are in their own hands. And that if they can't exercise their democratic right at the ballot box, they're going to take to the streets. They're either going to migrate to places that can give them the opportunities they want. Look at what's just happened in Spain. Or they're going to take to the streets and tell their governments and demand that their governments listen to them here and now. They're not going to wait for 4 years for an election cycle. Look at what's going on in Kenya right now. And I think that this is both very good news as well as very alarming news, because it's talking to a generation of consumers, of leaders, of workers who see themselves having agency to change their circumstances, but are not going to hang around for the next election process to do that.
South Africa is an outlier in a lot of the results that came out. Is that because it's ahead of the field or behind?
No. You know, sadly, and this is very sad for me, as I see the rest of the continent surging ahead in so many different ways, South Africa is completely being left behind. Part of the reason for that, in my view, is that the rest of the continent has moved through this belief that their governments in Africa have any ability to deliver prosperity. We're still, however, dealing with a South Africa who are living through the hangover of 1994, where the ANC came out and said, vote ANC and we will give you a house and we will give you a job and we will ensure your prosperity. And I think while the rest of the continent has got real, South Africans are still waiting for government to provide. Now, the truth is, in the world today, in 2026, no government on their own can provide. It doesn't matter where you are. It doesn't matter who you are. Not even Donald Trump can lead a government that can provide. What governments can do is they can create an enabling environment. They can create policies. They can create a legal system. And then they can get out of the way. And I think that what the African youth are demanding is that their governments get out of the way. And I think that what South Africa is heading to is exactly that. It's just behind the curve.
Now, if the youth are not voting, but they don't like what the government is doing, is there a risk here of a Arab Spring type event or July 2021 KZN recurrence?
So, again, my personal interpretation of the data, sadly, absolutely. I mean, I don't advocate for it. I don't think it's the answer. But I think that if youth's issues or African youth's issues are not addressed head on, and other ways are not found to deal with these issues, it is inevitable that they are going to take to the streets. And what form that will take will be different in every country. You know, previous editions of the youth survey predicted the military coups. They accurately predicted the very low youth voter turnover in countries in environments that failed or governments that failed. We do need to pay this some very serious attention. The youth plan to get out there and make themselves heard. Exactly how? Still to be determined.
What should we be looking for then in the November election? Because the political parties are telling us they've made progress amongst the youth. They've got more people registered. The IEC is telling us they are independent and that there's no reason to not believe that the voter returns are not going to be exactly accurate. What can we look for there that can be interpreted in the context of this survey that's just landed?
Well, my biggest concern, as I said, in South Africa is voter turnout. I think that voter apathy is the biggest risk to our democracy, and I think that political parties right across the board need to be focusing on getting people into the ballot boxes. There is no way that South Africa's future is going to start turning unless South Africans right across the board, including the youth, feel that they've had a say in the government we get. You know, I'm a great believer in the fact that a country gets the government they deserve. And if you don't bother to go out and vote, if you don't bother to exercise your democratic right that so many people died for, that so many people fought for, then there's a real fundamental problem in society that has to be dealt with. The pessimism we see in South Africa is really, really alarming at every single level. And it tells you that even in a country where the GDP is improving, where economic outlook is much better than in many other countries in Africa, people still remain pessimistic. Because where the rubber hits the road, they don't feel as if they're included in the economy. They don't feel that they're included in the decision-making process. And I think that every political party's focus right now needs to be get out the vote. Get as many people into the ballot boxes as possible. Because then we'll either have a credible representative government or we won't.
And I guess that the big issue there that you talk about with the voter turnout is something when you look back in South Africa, it continues to decline. Why do you think that is? Given, again, the context, the amazing context that you have of this continent and the people that you know in the continent and this survey and the being able to see the different progressions in various countries in their transfer to democracy. Is it just that we started too late in 1994?
No, I think that there are many, many reasons. It's a very, very complex kind of debate and discussion. I mentioned I've just finished the Winnie Mandela documentary, and the Winnie Mandela documentary was an incredible experience for me because I was able to go and relive the struggle history and go and remind myself about what our fight was about and the suffering and the horrors of the apartheid period. And how committed the energy that existed in the country as that transformation took place. And sadly, you know, people have forgotten what we fought for. People have forgotten what it was like to be disenfranchised. And instead of embracing that and reminding ourselves how privileged we are to have a democratic system where every single person's voice counts, people have become so pessimistic and so depressed that they honestly believe that their voice doesn't count and that they have no ability to make change. Now, if you look at Winnie's story, love her or hate her, she was scared of nothing and nobody because she knew that she could make a difference. And every single South African has agency. Every single South African has the ability to go and make a difference at their most local level and at a national level. One of the other things that the survey is telling us is young South Africans don't want to go into government. They don't want to go and serve society. You know, in my generation, everybody wanted to go into government. You know, people felt that if they were in government, they could make a difference. And then later on, they understood that if they were in government, they had a license to print money because that's unfortunately how things evolved. Today, the youth don't want to go into government. And that's very concerning because who's going to lead us? You know, if we land up with the lowest common denominator in government because they can't get opportunities elsewhere, well, that's also not democracy. It's also not the way that the country should be evolving.
Yeah, I think there's an argument that that's already happened, and you'll have to turn that whole story around. But just to close off with going back to your industry, the defense industry has been, well, it's been persona non grata, I think, to a large degree in the common discourse, but in recent times, with what we've seen in Ukraine and in the Middle East as well, do you feel that there's a realization that it's nice not to have a gun, but if you're living in a bad area, you better have one for self-protection?
You know, Alec, unfortunately, this has been a bugbear of mine for years, and governments have done, and certainly our government has done too little, and it might well be too late. Today in the world, defense industrial sovereignty is probably the single most important sovereign asset and sovereign capability that any country in the world can have. You know, Europe, over years, because of exactly the same things as you've just described, has denuded its defense industry, and now there is a scramble for the recreation of defense industrial capacity. You have exactly the same thing going on in Asia, in Central Asia, and in South America. here in South Africa, we are still blessed with a functioning defense industry. It's sad that companies like Paramount are the last man standing. It's sad that we've had no support from government over the years. In fact, until very recently, Paramount has not even done any business with the South African government because it has just been so unwelcome in this environment. But it is a sovereign asset that needs to be a source of national pride. We have a defense industry that is today feeding defense industrial or the regeneration of defense industrial capability in 20 countries around the world. This is something for us to be so proud of and so positive about. We also have to put proper effort into rebuilding our defense industry in South Africa. Unfortunately, Africa still has the biggest number of hotspots, conflict hotspots in the world. A lot of this is driven by fundamentalism and terrorism. A lot of this has to do with recruiting for elsewhere in the world. A lot of this has to do with economic issues. But the truth is that African governments, South Africa included, are facing real threats from insurgency. You know, the terror threat that faces South Africa is in Mozambique, on our borders, within literally tens of kilometers of South Africa. These are real issues. And having a defense industrial capability in South Africa today is no longer optional. And I'm very hopeful that government will come to that realization. But with all the huge internal challenges that they're facing, it's kind of understandable that they haven't got their heads around the fact that we face real challenges to our sovereignty if we don't re-establish our defense industrial capability, re-establish our defense force, and take pride in being able to protect ourselves and play a role in peacekeeping and counter-terrorism activities in the rest of the continent.
Well, we did have Danel at one point, and we certainly at that point would have thought that we had the defense sovereignty. And maybe you can explain that to people who don't know what those terms mean and what the downside might be.
Well, the issue around defense industrial sovereignty is all driven from the fact that when the chips are down and Ukraine has, the situation in Ukraine has demonstrated this, and when everybody is at threat, under threat, availability of defense equipment becomes very, very rare. So a country that has the capacity to manufacture is not sharing with other countries when they need what they make for themselves. Countries that have different ideologies just stop delivering to countries that they don't agree with in the conflict. And as a result, you know, in Europe, and every part of Europe is under threat today, we must call a spade a spade. The reality is that Europe is in a state of virtual war and has the risk of being at war in the very near terms. There are many countries in Europe that cannot re-equip, that cannot create defense capacity because they just don't have the capacity to get the equipment they want. And this is not about money. It's got nothing to do with money. It's got to do with availability and resource to be able to produce for yourselves. So every country in Europe today is scrambling to be able to go back into the production environment. And it takes years and years and years. I mean, our defense industrial capability was built up over more than 100 years. You know, elements of our defense industry are 100 years old. And, you know, we've been the target of many countries who've tried to steal our people and steal our technology because people realize that the depth we have in South Africa is unique in the world. And as a result, the capability in the country has been denuded. A lot of our people have left. A young generation of engineers have not necessarily been built up to the extent that they should have been. I mean, Paramount has invested almost all its profits over the years in retraining people, in keeping capability alive, but with no support or help from government whatsoever. Sadly, Danel has been allowed to be denuded by external factors, by internal factors, and it is a shadow of its former self. It can absolutely be saved. There is no question Danel can be saved. It can be turned back into the powerhouse that it once was. There are still some incredible technologies in Donnell, and there are some incredibly capable individuals who are fighting to try and save this state enterprise and this national asset, with absolutely no support from government, from the private sector. And until South Africa changes its approach completely, this will not turn around. And we are now at a point where if we want to save Donnell, we have literally months to do it. The capability that exists is denuded to such an extent that we can build on what's there today. But in a year or 18 months' time, there'll be nothing to build on. And I now, we've built a global business, and I've spent the last couple of years taking what we've been able to learn in the African environment and transferring it into businesses elsewhere in the world. I've decided to double down on South Africa. Today I'm no longer active in the business, but I am an investor. I have a vision for the future of the defense industry in Africa. And I've decided to double down on helping Africa to create defense industrial sovereignty. I'm prepared to do exactly the same in South Africa. I'm prepared to invest in South Africa, but I can't do so unless government is open to that. We've gone and helped other countries create defense industries from scratch. Here we're not starting from scratch. We've got a base. And all we need is commitment from government and a desire from South Africans to want the industry. Today the defense industry can't even be banked in South Africa.
What would it take then? How much would it take? Would it take a minister of finance to get together with a minister of defense and come up with a plan that convinces the president? Would it take a government of national unity to see things differently? Or would it take international investment that's welcomed?
You know what? We have all the capability we need right here in South Africa. I mean, we're investing in other countries to create defense industries. So it's not about foreign investment. In fact, the one thing we don't want is foreign investment, because that's not how you create sovereignty. This needs to be a South African industry built by South Africans using South African capital. It's not even an issue of capital, because at the end of the day, the Defence Force has operational requirement. It needs to spend the money somewhere, and all it needs to do is to commit to spend the money. Our Defence Force is still using equipment that comes out of the apartheid era. It has remarkable new equipment in the Air Force for which there's no money to maintain or keep flying. It's not like we don't have anything. We've got an industry that can give us the latest and the greatest equipment. We've got capability in South Africa that can maintain our equipment. I mean, Paramount provides the back end of the supersonic fleet that provides red air training services to the F-35 pilots in the United States. Yet South Africa cannot maintain its own Gripen aircraft. All the capability exists right here. We don't need to bring it in from anywhere else in the world. Somebody just needs to want to do it. Somebody just needs to say in government, we need a defense force. We need world-class equipment and capability. We need to upgrade the equipment that our soldiers are using. Everything is available right here in South Africa. Just let's get engaged with industry and start making it happen. And with just that, we can revitalize this industry literally overnight. This is about will. It's not about cash. It's not about anything else.
Ava, it's been fascinating talking with you. Thank you for your time. Thank you for sharing with us not just the survey, but your thoughts on the continent and on South Africa itself. I'm sure that the members of the BizNews tribe will also enjoy picking up on your insights, and we hope this isn't the last time. Ava Ishikowitz is the founder of the Paramount Group. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com. Start your day a step ahead. BizNews Insider. It delivers the business stories that matter every morning straight to your inbox, sharp, fast, and free. Subscribe now.